Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, welcome, welcome to the French Connections Thursday edition. Today's date is the 19th day of August, 2010. Of course, my name is Daryl Bradford Smith, and I'm happy to have you all with me on this voyage of discovery. Another great opportunity here to learn, and this is what life's all about. We never stop learning. Lots of stuff to share today about our medical system with my guest, Nancy Turner Banks, MD, or Nancy Banks, good friend, honest gal, hard-working woman, worked her life trying to help people stay healthy and made a lot of discoveries along the way. So many that toward the end of her career, she began questioning allopathic medicine because things didn't add up in her mind. The things that she saw on the ground and what she saw in her practice didn't seem to fit the party line, if you will. And it was enough to pique her interest into doing some research. And as she started uncovering things, she even got more interested. And it led her to a lot of discoveries, including writing a book, which we're going to be talking about today. It's called AIDS, Opium, Diamonds, and Empire, The Deadly Virus of International Greed. Now, I must take credit for some of her interest in this, because when we first started talking, she had all of the right questions being asked when we were discussing things privately. And then a few other things were brought up, and she said, that's exactly what I found, and oh my goodness, and next thing you know, she's researching. And that's what people who end up as doctors have spent a lot of time in their lives, especially in their early lives as students, becoming doctors, researching. And that has always been interesting for Nancy, and she brought her extensive abilities to bear on several subjects, and not the least of which was the vaccine fraud, but she also got involved in looking at AIDS. And of course, we all know that what we were told and what we continue to be told about AIDS is inaccurate, and in most instances completely fraudulent. And what were the goals of this AIDS virus, and what are they still continuing today? And in my view, and in many people's views, it's a depopulation tool, or it's a societal subjugation tool. It's a geopolitical tool to exclude. It's a lot of things. But what it certainly isn't is what they've told us it is as a disease. And it more than likely's cause is poverty, mixed with introductions of vaccines and other things, but I'll let Nancy do that. She's more qualified to talk about those things. But we're going to also talk about her book in a general way, and hopefully over the next few weeks, I will have Nancy Banks back on to examine her book in a little more depth. We're not going to go page by page as we did with the Synagogue of Satan. What we're going to do is try to pique your interest in the research that she did and the information she found. And hopefully you'll be interested in getting one of these fabulous books for yourself and learning a great deal about what's going on in our medical system and in the world for that matter. Nancy, are you with me?
Yes, I am, Daryl. How are you today?
I'm doing great, Nancy. It's great to have you back. You know, you're one of my favorite people to talk to on radio and privately, for that matter, because there's just a sweetness about you that's just really great. And I'm kind of like a bull in a china shop most of the time. So when I come across somebody as nice as you, I actually mellow out a little bit. this is a good thing, you know. Well, you know, this whole mess we're in, it does require a host of skills, from bull in a china shop all the way to kind and generous-hearted people. So we need everybody in this fight, and your fight is right now bringing some facts to bear on this medical system that we've got and these geopolitical fraud of AIDS. The book basically doesn't leave out any specific area. You go into geopolitics, you go into the fraud of vaccines, you go into so many things. You want to give us a little overview of what brought you to the book and what some of the more salient issues are that you treat in the text?
Well, as you probably know, and most of your listeners know, that AIDS was positioned as a sexually transmitted disease.
Yep.
And as a gynecologist, I'm an expert and trained to treat and take care of sexually transmitted diseases. And I was not, they were saying that it was going to pass from the homosexual community and the IV drug users and the hemophiliacs, and it was going to become this heterosexual pandemic throughout the planet. And I practiced obstetrics and gynecology for a long time, and so did any number of colleagues of mine. And we weren't seeing that. And then all of a sudden, this disease, which was primarily impacting the white male homosexual community, all of a sudden became a disease of black women. And they were hyping that angle. And from an epidemiological point of view, it simply did not make sense. And that's when I began to look into this issue.
Well, let me ask you a question about the this is general knowledge I have, and I know at the same time in New York City and in San Francisco, they came out with a recommendation for the homosexual community to receive hepatitis B shots. And I don't know what connection the hepatitis B vaccine had to people ultimately being diagnosed with AIDS, but there was some sort of connection there, if I'm not mistaken. Am I correct in that assertion?
Well, the problem was is that hepatitis is one of the diseases that can be transmitted through sex and blood, and the hepatitis vaccine also is one of the vaccines that cross reacts with the so-called HIV antibody test. So those people who had that vaccine were in a high-risk group to begin with in terms of their lifestyle and behavior and intake of environmental toxins, largely a great number of drugs. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, they have this vaccine, which also cross-reacts with the antibody test. So they were in a high-risk group, and that was really this vaccine contributed to making it look as if they were infected with a virus.
Well, now, the annual nitrate use, which nitrates and nitrites used in our foods even, are dangerous for our health. In fact, when you eat too many treated sausages with lots of nitrates as a preservative, you toxify your body in a detrimental way for your immune system. So, essentially, what I'm saying is that this homosexual community was big on these, what they call poppers, and this kind of set them up for all of this, the symptomology of this, and basically led them a path to taking untested medicines and the rest of it. Are we going down the right road with the homosexual community?
Well, poppers certainly was because it has a nitric oxide. It's known to be carcinogenic and very damaging to the cells. But that was only one drug. If you go back to the original reports of the doctors who were treating these patients were multi-drug users. I think one or two of them were even heroin addicts. So they were taking enormous number of drugs. Poppers, it turns out, was the drug that was related to one of the initial events, which was called Kaposi sarcoma, which mm-hmm. is a type of a blood vessel cancer. But the Kaposi sarcoma was never connected with the HIV antibody test. So it was just one of those cancers that the early patients often showed up with, and it seemed to be related to these poppers. But they were also very stressed out because of the lifestyle that they were living. And remember, this was only a subset of which was called fast track. Group of men. It was never widespread in the homosexual community, but this group of what was called fast track men were living a particularly dangerous lifestyle. For 10 to 15 years, they were taking numerous drugs. They were having multiple sexual partners, sometimes in dirty bathhouses, and they were stressed out, and they weren't eating properly. And it was almost like a train wreck waiting to happen.
Yeah.
And when they initially showed up in the emergency room, the doctors felt that the problem was a toxic problem. Mm-hmm. But the CDC and the National Institute of Health soon intervened to make it seem as if it were an infectious problem rather than a problem of toxicology.
Yeah, well, now we can go back to the morphing of what they called polio, and then every 10 years they seem to rename the symptoms of polio a new disease, and that's not dissimilar from what they did in that regard. Am I onto something with that?
Yes, because as you probably recall, polio started showing up after they started spraying DDT.
That's right. Yep.
And so the symptoms of DDT poisoning were the same symptoms of the people who were developing polio.
And they actually came out with a polio vaccine at the downside of people actually reporting polio outbreaks, and so that they made it seem like whatever it was that they had come up with was actually curing a problem that in fact was going away because they weren't poisoning the environment that people were in many instances.
Well, that's if you look at the history of vaccines and you go back 100 years, not, you know, when they look at vaccines, they look at a very short timeline to make it look as if the vaccines are actually reducing the amount of disease. But if you go back 100 years and you see when these vaccines were introduced and you see the fact that the diseases were on the downward slope, and the vaccines didn't accelerate the trend, you understand that the propaganda about the vaccines is bigger than the actual effect of the vaccines.
Well, now let's move into the African American community, specifically the women that were coming in with these diagnoses. Was it a poverty and drug use for them as well, or what, lifestyle, or was it something more race-specific within the construct of this toxicity?
Well, there were two things. The one was that the drug war. I said one of the things that it's very clear to the African American community is that they're sort of like the beta testers for what the elites want to do to the entire society.
Yep.
So if the elites want to bring drugs into the society, the first community they dump them in is the African American community.
Yep.
And of course, after the Vietnam War, heroin came in, and then with the Iran-Contra debacle, the crack cocaine issue became a problem. And so crack cocaine was something that many black men began to take, but many black women began to take. And there was a relationship between the use of drugs and HIV positivity.
Mm-hmm.
So the toxins, the oxidizing agents, which these drugs are, was causing immune stress. And that immune stress began to look like it was what they called AIDS. And it made these people more prone to have more antibodies. The other thing that's specific for the African American community, and this is really important, people of African descent make more antibodies to a given stimulus. It's just like people of African descent have darker skin. They make more antibodies. It's just a fact, more IgG and IgA antibodies. The other thing is, with that HIV test, the HIV test is an antibody test. It is not a test to identify a virus.
No one has ever isolated the AIDS virus to this day, have they?
Exactly. And so this is we should talk about that before this discussion is over.
Mm-hmm.
But the HIV test is an antibody test. So everyone should really understand that. It doesn't directly test for a virus. It is an indirect test which looks at proteins which they claim come are a reaction to this particular virus. But that's a big story. Now, one of the things that is also more common among people of African descent is a particular protein called HLA-DR5. And that just happens to be one of the antibody proteins which is in the HIV antibody test. So it seems from the epidemiology that black people are five times more often than Caucasians to have a positive HIV antibody test. So if this in fact is a sexually transmitted disease, you have to assume that the black people have different sexual habits, and that is absolutely unproven.
Yep.
So this in itself was a very big point for me. Also, I think I'm the first one who really has identified how the African-American community was targeted with this HIV antibody.
Well, you made a very important point that we've discussed privately, Nancy, and I know that family values and family cohesion in the black community back in the 40s and 50s was parallel or even stronger in many instances than the the overall white population in the United States. And there were no high divorce rates, and there were no single parent families and so forth. And then what happened was they brought in social stresses that started eroding those figures. And of course, again, social experimenting on that black community as a harbinger of things to come for the white community. And in fact, exactly 10 years earlier than the white community, we started seeing the divorce rate skyrocket in mainstream America, 10 years after the blacks began their problems with divorce and family problems. So what you're saying is that again, there's a lot of evidence that while it is not conclusive, it's too clear to call it coincidence, in my view. I mean,
there is some evidence that there were social engineering programs targeted, because the RAND Corporation produced documents which can be found, and those documents basically talked about how to specifically target the African American community, and they used words like a plan shrinkage. And one of the things they did, especially I remember in New York, after, for example, in the Bronx, as many of the whites began to move into the suburbs, blacks and Hispanics moved into the Bronx, and what they did is they started taking larger apartments and making them into multiple living units. So the areas became more crowded. They began to reduce the amount of services. They stopped picking up trash as often. They reduced the amount of police. They closed down fire stations, and they started bringing in drugs, and then they started closing factories and moving factories off to developing countries. So it was like a powder keg waiting to happen. Yeah. Oh, and the other thing is that they started letting people out of the mental institutions.
Yep.
They started putting them on these drugs and leaving them on the street.
Yeah. And anybody who's traveled Jerome Avenue knows what blighted inner cities can be, and sadly, that wasn't always the case in the Bronx. Jerome Avenue was a thriving area in the 50s. There was a lot of healthy businesses, and of course, again, as they moved in the newer population, they allowed the thing to just go down. Today it's descended into a war zone, not dissimilar from Beirut. So my point is that they have engineered these things, and the consequences now are for health are immediate. Now, we know that when you live in close proximity, that they have proof of this from the early part of the last century, when they were looking at the Lower East Side as a test area, that people living in close proximity without the proper nutrition and diet and poverty levels and so forth had much higher disease rates, and it was basically a poverty situation. Is that a correct statement to make, Nancy?
Yeah, absolutely, Daryl, and that's one of the reasons that the vaccine thing was a myth, because once the living situations for people got better, the sanitation improved, and their nutrition improved, and their education improved, their diseases started going down. For example, when the Irish first came to the United States, they had a very high rate of tuberculosis, but they lived in very close, poor quarters. But as the Irish started integrating into the society and becoming more educated and becoming more prosperous, there is no connection to the Irish with tuberculosis any longer.
Yep.
And so the thing that really made the infectious disease problem almost disappear in this country was an economic situation where people got a little more prosperous, they were able to find better housing, they were able to educate their children, and there was good sanitation instituted by the public works.
Well, now here we are with this American part or American slice of the pie here and the slice of the story. And now let's talk a little bit about how this fraud was exported to Africa, where it had almost no connection to the homosexual community, and by and large was earmarked for countries that were experiencing either civil war or poverty or outbreaks of other problems, that they rushed in with vaccines, and immediately after these vaccines hit the streets, instead of improving these people's foodstuffs and so forth, they came in with vaccine and said, this is going to save you, and all of a sudden the whole society started deteriorating into what they called AIDS, but in fact was basically a combination of probably the vaccines and poverty. And so what we saw is a huge number of people probably dying from poverty and a combination of the above mentioned situation. Now, is that correct to say?
Yes. One of the things that happened after, even before World War II ended, was a meeting which took place in New Hampshire at a place called Bretton Woods, New Hampshire.
Yep.
And a group of international bankers and politicians and businessmen came together, and they created the World Bank and the IMF. And one of the reasons they were doing this is because the old forms, the World War II was really the turning point for the old forms of direct intervention of European colonialism in other countries. They realized that they were no longer going to be able to control these countries with direct military force, that the people were having uprisings from India to Africa to China, and they had to figure out another way of taking control of these countries. And the way they came up with was through the banking system. And what they were going to do is they were going to put all of these countries that were former colonial powers, they were going to lend them money that never existed. Mm-hmm. It's called fractional reserve banking, which you've talked about considerably on your show. Mm-hmm. And they were going to make all of these countries indebted to these banks. And as a result of this indebtedness, these people, the lifestyle of these people, which was not terrific to begin with, was going to deteriorate, because they would ask them, in order to repay these loans, they said you would have to cut back on social services, on health care, on roads, on education, all of the things that we know make a society viable. So these people were asked to destroy their own societies. And these the people at the bank made sure that the heads of all of these colonial countries, if they didn't go along with this, they were killed or deposed. As a result, the health care of this continent has deteriorated considerably over the last 40 to 50 years.
Yeah. Now, they on top of that, from what I know about what happened during those early part of the 1970s and 80s, of course, as these people, these leaders ran off with the public purse, and they usually lived in Paris or Paris suburban multi-million dollar dwelling, the population was left to service the debt on the IMF or World Bank loans, and in exchange for that, they had to give up their natural resources or the land or whatever. And on top of that, they were subjugated through the use of food aid rather than growing it in gardens of their own or sticking to traditional diets. And while certain things did help their populations to expand, the pressure on people to get a good meal, a good well-balanced meal, deteriorated, if I'm remembering what I read. So basically, these people were set up to be sick. I mean, if you or I lived in that situation, we'd fall ill, no doubt as well.
Well, for example, let's look at South Africa, for example.
Yep.
Even today, after the fall of apartheid, the arable 61% of the arable land is still held in large tracts, mainly by the minority white population. So that means the majority black population is still relegated to small tracts of land, which is not the best land for doing anything on. And so the secondary situation in South Africa, of course, is the mining issue, because the gold and the diamonds are embedded in silica and asbestos, and those things are very damaging to the lung. And secondarily, the people who work in those mines develop tuberculosis. And what do you know? As soon as the apartheid government of South Africa fell, pulmonary tuberculosis now became a sexually transmitted disease. They said that that pulmonary tuberculosis was now going to be an AIDS-defining disease. And this, what this did economically was to prevent these miners from then suing the mining companies for the poor conditions in the mine,
yeah,
and for the development of their disease, and that, it was a business decision, a very evil business decision.
Well, do you remember Thabo Mbeki in the early part of his time as president in South Africa, and there was a lot of public pressure from the outside for him to use AZT and AIDS drugs, and he refused. He said there's no evidence. I remember reading this. He would say there was no evidence that these things help AIDS patients, and in fact there is evidence that they may hurt, and he kept them out for the first 2 years of his administration, or maybe 3 years. Finally, public pressure from the outside in forced him to begin to allow these drugs in, and instead of reducing the amount of mortality involved with this, in fact it went up. So he was not wrong, and instead of treating it as an issue of individual health, say, nutrition and so forth, they tried these Western drugs, these beta blockers. I don't know what they're called. They're all kinds of stuff.
Well, they're antiretrovirals.
Antiretrovirals. Okay. Well, these things clearly were exacerbating the health condition of many of these people rather than helping. And so essentially, he wasn't wrong, but he had to switch either that or, as you said earlier on in this conversation, you ended up dead or deposed. So he actually switched his opinion and allowed these drugs in him. Do you remember any part of that?
Well, first of all, he was a very smart man, and he also is an economist. And he simply raised the question, and this was, he understood that there was controversy surrounding the HIV/AIDS paradigm. And so he wanted to have an open discussion, which in science you should be allowed to have, because
yeah,
there's no such thing as settled science. Mm-hmm. Never is there settled science. There is consensus, and science seems to make sense until somebody discovers something new, and then it doesn't make sense. So with the HIV/AIDS issue, Mbeki simply wanted the people who believed in HIV/AIDS and the people who questioned the theory of HIV/AIDS to come together and to have an open discussion so that he could make an informed decision for how he wanted to move forward with his people. Well, the New York Times called him irresponsible. The Bill Clinton administration put pressure on him. The liberal Bill Clinton administration put pressure on him. And he was practically ostracized. They acted as if he was some monster. And there was unremitting pressure in the Western press.
Yeah, that's right. And so I remember that. And in fact, I was saying to myself, what a vicious cretin he is. Because, of course, at that time, I believed the pabulum of the masses. And I sadly went along with a lot of the things that I read. And today, of course, I know better. But I remember reading that stuff. So here we are now. Okay. Let's go into the book a little bit, Nancy. And we've kind of laid the groundwork of where your research has brought you and what we've done here. But there are specifics that you've written about that almost no one else has really treated in depth. And I do understand that death by vaccine from Eustace Mullins helped you a little bit when you were doing some research. But and what other sources for your book were important to you? What other sources did you rely on heavily for?
Eustace's book is Death by Medicine.
Death by Medicine, yes.
Yeah, I really looked at the economics, and one of the things that I looked at was a book called The Creature from Jekyll Island.
Yep.
And Eustace Mullins has written extensively on the Federal Reserve.
Yep.
So I really wanted to know about this Federal Reserve and this banking system and how this banking system relates to what is going on. So I did quite a bit of research into the international banks and how the international banks have impacted this century.
Yep. Yeah, and well, that's been my studies from the beginning here. Now, the first chapter you wrote in here, it says called The Big Lie and the Art of War. What did you mean by that, and what issues do you treat in that first chapter?
Yeah, one of the things that I talk about, especially with the art of war, most people, when they think of war, they think of armies and militaries, mm-hmm. and they think of battles, and they think of bombs and those kinds of things. And most people don't realize that the biggest thing in war is a psychological operation.
That's right.
Because, even Sun Tzu talks about it. If you can bring the enemy over to your side, then you don't really have to, you have very little struggle, because the enemy's already believing that whatever you want them to believe.
That's right.
So most of us don't have taken a long time to realize that there are certain elements in this society, and of course I looked at the pharmaceutical industry, that they create a psychological warfare against people. And that by that I mean that they want to create an image which is a false image of what their products do.
Yeah.
And so they have a lot of money to do this. They do it with television ads, they do it with radio, they do it with newspapers, and they do it because they have the money to shut out those people who would come out against what they want to have you believe. And so they shape and form public opinion. And just as you said a few minutes ago, that you thought Mbeki was an idiot,
yeah.
because he was not going along with what you thought was the AIDS paradigm.
Yep. Yeah.
And so even intelligent, informed people will form these opinions, and we don't even know how we form these opinions. We just have them.
Well, I got to say, you got Institut Pasteur saying he's a crazy. You've got, you've got Montagnier over in America, who's, they vaulted to the level of a god with all the. In other words, they're putting out they're building their propaganda troops with these halos around their information instead of dissecting the information, and then they put out statements that say, Mbeki's decisions are costing lives and killing people, and all of a sudden you see him as as the Saddam Hussein of the southern tip of Africa.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, just look at this last H1N1 debacle from last year.
Yeah.
And how the WHO, the World Health Organization, and the CDC hyped that debacle. And then you find out that the people who were hyping the H1N1 vaccine were getting kickbacks from the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah.
And they knew from the very beginning that it was a ruse. But they were going to play that out because it was a profitable ruse.
Global warming is another one.
So that's the problem. So the psychological warfare is a big part of warfare, and so that's what I really wanted to get people to understand. If they can control your mind, they can control. After they have your mind, it doesn't matter. You'll act in the way that they want you to act.
Well, now your next chapter talks about silent weapons, and you want to expand on that.
Silent weapons, the thing about silent weapons is that, for example, psychological operations are silent weapons.
Yeah.
The other thing is of silent weapons is that the economy, how you manage the economy is a silent weapon.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if you have a debt-based monetary system, you're eventually going to put people in debt to the point where they're not going to be able to do anything except service that debt. So that makes people busy, 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 and they're not going to be thinking about, they're not going to have time to think and to become wise and to delve into what's going on. They're just going to be busy servicing that debt. So debt becomes a silent weapon.
Yeah, I agree. And there's a lot of I'm going to be bringing to the discussion about how they've used the law to affect the control grid over us all through Admiralty and the rest. But there are other silent weapons, and one of them is political correctness, Nancy. You know, one of the things that's happened, they have always known that keeping the the black community away from the knowing the white community and segregating us and not allowing us to become brothers and friends and enjoy kindnesses together. They've wanted to make sure they had two competing groups in America. Now, they've done the same thing here in Europe with the Arab community. And so I have had the advantage of seeing the same game played with a different racial group, and there are no differences between the way they've done it, and this is what is glaring when you end up living in Europe. There is a black community here, but it's not treated in the same way it is in America. They do what they're doing to the African American in America to the Arabs here. And it's unbelievable, but this also creates an inability for us to handle social problems and be honest about how we go forward with health and with social interaction in general. And it's also silent, but because they've imposed these belief systems through political correctness and they make things worse. Every bad decision, and a good one I can bring up right now, which immediately when for you even when you were a doctor going into Harvard University, which is an incredible accomplishment you had, there were people out in the world, especially in the white community, because of political correctness, that said you didn't deserve to be there. The only reason you were there was because you were an African American. And these kinds of things that people believe are put into their heads through clandestine means, through political correctness. And so they use these things to destroy our ability to communicate with generations, our old people and young people, different racial groups, different cultural groups. And there we are, all polarized all around us. Nobody's talking. Everybody's believing what they're being told. And we never put up a united front. Is any of or all of that part of the way you believe things are?
That, I mean, in the United States, that actually started from the earliest times when the first blacks that came here were not slaves. They were actually indentured servants, and so were many of the whites who first came here.
Yep.
And what happened is that the indentured servants, blacks and whites, were working together against the landowners, against the cruel conditions in the colonies.
Yep.
And so the owners of the plantations understood from very early on that they needed to find a way to distance these two working class people. And so that's how this whole racial thing happened in the United States, is because early on the indentured servants recognized that they had a common enemy, but the common enemy understood that they could separate, divide, and conquer. And they're excellent at that.
Oh, yeah.
And the other reason they're excellent at it is because we are so easy to be prejudiced against other people.
Yes, yes. And of course you can look back and of course Aaron Lopez up in Newport, Rhode Island, being the richest a Jewish family in America, all bar none, made his fortune by shipping millions of African slaves for the price of barrels of rum in Africa. And I mean, you take a look at it, and who profited from keeping the system going? You'll find the same suspects, but only a few hundred years back. Yes, there's a lot more to be said in that chapter. I've read this whole book, Nancy. I'm going to skip over this quickly because we're not trying to give everybody the book. We're trying to give you an overview so that there's enough in here to spend a couple of good solid days of reading and learning. And I'm starting to read your book for the second time, so it's really well written. I got to be honest with you, the style of writing is easy and very powerful. The next one I want to talk about is the Flex. And we along with Jennifer Lake and others, we've talked about these people. In fact, I think you and I had a conversation a few years back about the Flexners, and we all came to the same kinds of conclusions. And what have you found to add to that Flexner equation?
Yeah, Jenny Lake's research was actually very helpful to me, because I knew about the two Flexner brothers, but I didn't know about the third one until she introduced me to that, and so I researched it further. But these three brothers were interesting. they were hired by the Rockefeller and Carnegie foundations to really create a counter-revolution in the United States. And that counter-revolution was in education and in the realm of politics. For example, these three brothers, two of them took over the allopathic medicine system, and the third brother was part of the people who founded the Council on Foreign Relations, and he also was part of the Zionist delegation to the Versailles Peace Conference, where the Germans, when they understood how the Americans were duped into coming into the First World War by this very powerful political group, and when the Balfour Declaration was presented, they realized how they had been betrayed.
Yeah. And actually, Ben Friedman talks a lot about this, and it's about connections to Morgenthau and Baruch and Brandeis and others. But those people are all the people that circulated around Woodrow Wilson. So the Flexner brothers were very high level operatives within the structure of Rockefeller, who, by the way, Rockefeller's financing for Standard Oil and his railroad holdings and others were actually seed money given to him by a Rothschild.
Through J.P. Morgan, I think.
That's right, through J.P. Morgan, and J.P. Morgan acted as the conduit, but Rockefeller was really the organizer, and he did it through trust relationships. He set up trust situations where he was outside the individual law and set up what he was calling generous offerings to the society. We're going to make education better for you. We're going to improve your medicine. We're going to help you live better. And in fact, it was anything but that. In fact, it was...
The Rees Commission was set up in 1953-54 to look at what the foundations were really doing. And they came to the understanding that these foundations were using their considerable wealth to social engineer the society in the direction which these wealthy people wanted the society to go. And which means that people are not free to make their own decisions because they're being moved in a particular direction by the programs instituted by these so-called foundations.
That's right.
But the other thing about the Rockefellers, you have to know that the Rockefellers never did anything for which they were not going to get a significant return on their investments.
That's right. That's right.
So, for example, the foundation money that went into financing the allopathic medical school system was going to pay them handsomely because they were now going to train a cadre of physicians who were going to actually be salespeople for their drugs that they manufactured in their pharmaceutical industry. It was actually quite brilliant how they did that. And so they chose, after Abraham Flexner wrote the Flexner Report on Medical Education. Now, some of what they did was actually beneficial because there were a lot of terrible medical schools in the country at that time or poor training, and they did do some good. But the problem is that many other disciplines, such as naturopathy, homeopathy, and those things that didn't promote the drugs, the radiation, or the surgery, were now going to be considered quackery.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing that they were going to give credence to was going to be the particular paradigm that the Rockefellers supported. And that's where they put all their money. So the medical schools, they diminished right away. They went from several hundred to about 50.
Yeah.
And there were a few schools, for example, homeopathic schools and naturopathic schools that were able to survive over the century, but there are very few of them left.
Well, France still has homeopathic pharmacies and doctors here because they did not have the same pressures here in France to eradicate those forms of medical study. However, they too in the modern world are being marginalized, and of course Codex Alimentarius is now the law here in Europe. So if you want natural solutions to your health questions, you pay even more money than you would for a regular drug now, and which is the whole goal for it to be. They're not getting rid of of your ability to get these natural medicines or natural elements. They're just making them so expensive that most people won't be able to afford to even get their hands on them. And this is, yeah.
Well, you know what they do, Daryl? For example, they create organizations like the Federal, the Food and Drug Commission,
yeah.
The Food and Drug Administration, and the FDA, ostensibly, again, it's supposed to make sure that the products that are put on the market are safe. But what it does also is if you're a small producer, it puts you out of business because there is no way you can comport with the paperwork and the requirements required of these government agencies.
That's right.
So these government agencies have been used to put the competition out of business.
That's right.
It's business.
And you know, one of the things we talked about privately, some of the powers that some of these natural substances such as curcumin have on our overall health. And, I mean, you can't deny some of the strengths that come out of natural medicine. And I'm not talking about, you know, if you break your leg at a compound fracture, you're going to need surgery. And I'm not saying to keep away from that going to your regular doctor, but there are also a lot of things that you can do naturally that don't require you to go in and get heavy sulfur drugs or whatever. I mean, cripes, you know, the farther I stay away from my doctor's medicines, the better I feel, usually, I think.
The thing about allopathic medicines, many of them are beneficial, and many of them have done some good. But a lot of them, especially now, there was a report that came out this week stating that 85% of the new drugs absolutely have no beneficial effect whatsoever. And I think that was striking that report even came out, because I think allopathic medicine has reached the limits of its viability. But this is the thing, Daryl. The universe is made up of positive and negative charges, and so are we, which means that we are energetic beings. And what happens over time is that you have to supply yourself from the outside with appropriate energy. You get that energy either through appropriate food or through nutritional products such as curcumin or antioxidants or polyphenols, which you are talking about. It's really not, this is not rocket science. This is like basic science. It's almost like as simple as if your car has no gas and your battery is run down, you put gas in the car and you rev up your battery.
Yeah.
And so essentially we're energetic beings. And so instead of saying we have an immune problem or this problem or that problem, essentially most of these problems are going to be shown to be problems of energy deficiency. And depending on our predisposition, this is where genes come in, we will develop particular problems. For example, some people will develop diabetes, some people hypertension, and some people will develop immune deficiencies, depending on the length of our deficits and our predisposition. It's not hard.
Well, I'm going to move on here because we're never going to get through the whole book. We're going to probably do a second invite here to go through this, Nancy. But I want to get on to here to the next chapter. It says HIV/AIDS, sloppy science, or the art of deception. We have treated that in some ways. Are there some important elements that we left out in our earlier?
Yeah, we really big. In 1984, a man by the name of Gallo published 4 studies in a magazine called Science.
Yep.
And supposedly these are the publications which started this whole big to-do about HIV and AIDS. He never isolated a unique virus, HIV. Never. And he was told that by his lead researcher, and by when you isolate a virus, you have to do a photograph of the virus, and it's called an electron micrograph. And the person who did the electron micrograph also wrote to him and told him he just had debris. He had cellular debris. But knowing that he had not isolated it, and this was during the Reagan administration, he and Margaret Heckler, who was the head of the Department of Health and the Health and Human Services, came out and said that Gallo had isolated the probable cause of AIDS. That's what they said, the probable cause of AIDS. However, this is where the psychological operation came in. right after that, the newspapers and magazines and television started saying the cause of AIDS had been discovered, it's HIV. And that's how they did it.
Now, how did they get Pasteur with Montagnier to go along with this
What happened is that Montagnier was also doing the similar research in France, and he actually sent some of his laboratory samples to Gallo, which Gallo stole. But Montagnier never isolated either. And Montagnier has actually stated any number of times that he never isolated. And so what happened is that Gallo was using some of the specimens from the Institut Pasteur in Paris. So that became a bit of a scandal. But again, I think that was a created scandal to make people think that the virus was isolated.
Okay. Well, and I noticed right away, as soon as Montagnier got his half credit or co-credit with Gallo, he was spirited off to a new laboratory in New York. And they paid for everything. And here in France, he was facing retirement because in France, at a certain age, regardless of your skills as a researcher, they say you retire. And he went off to America, and there was a big scandal over here in France. Oh, why are we getting rid of our best researcher? Blah, blah, blah. And he went to the United States, essentially, probably to silence any further information coming out of this guy. He hasn't come out with a darn thing supplemental that was going to be used to refute any of the claims made early on. So they've just kept up with the scam. It's really...
Well, actually, there's a video out now called, a movie called House of Numbers. And in that movie, Montagnier is interviewed, and he is actually saying that if you have a good nutrition and a good immune system, even if you're, he still says there's HIV, if you're exposed to HIV, you could be exposed to it many times and you won't get it, and even if you get it, if you have the proper nutrition, you can get rid of it. That's what he said in the House of Numbers.
Well, so he's still keeping part of the lie alive.
Yes.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he's beginning to talk about oxidative stress, and that really is the issue with immune deficiency. It's the energy issue of oxidative stress, but we won't get into that today.
Well, deindustrialization of the economic core, more immune toxins, how China fits into the big picture, the death knell for dollar hegemony. Here's one thing that Reustis taught me that I didn't know. This world epidemic of heroin use over the last century, you can look back at some of my favorite musicians and, Miles Davis and Billie Holiday. And that goes back to the 30s, 40s, 50s, into the 60s, of course, during Vietnam. What I didn't know was after 1948, China put 9 million, I thought it was 90,000, 9 million hectares or acres under cultivation of poppies. And their big export exchange product out of China for the first 25 years of China's existence, of the modern communist China's existence, was opium. And they became the world leader of opium production. And I didn't know that. And so essentially China has had a part in this crime wave since the founding of the communist regime there.
Well, actually, in the next chapter talks about the British East India Company. Once China got into the opium business, it never left.
It never left.
But what happened is that after the Second World War, the United States was in a particularly strong position economically.
That's right.
Because Europe had been devastated. The Southeast Asia was still emerging. And Latin America was not a problem because the United States would make sure with all of the coups that they sponsored that Latin America would be neutralized. So the United States was in a particularly strong position.
In fact, Nancy, 51% of world GDP after the war.
Right. The factories were booming. The overall economy of the country was good. And the country was healthy psychologically and physically. There was a low divorce rate. There was none of this easy sexuality that we see today. There was a stability in the society, even though the society had some racial problems and the society certainly wasn't free from its tensions. But communities, black or white, were relatively stable.
Yeah.
After Korea first, the drugs started really coming into the United States, mostly at that time into the black communities. Then after Vietnam, the drugs started pouring into the United States. But not only the heroin, the pharmaceutical companies were also releasing drugs, uppers, downers, quaaludes, amyl nitrate. It was almost like a pharmacopoeia of drugs were released into the baby boom population.
Yeah.
At the same time that the birth control pill came, and this whole change in sexual mores. So it was almost like a train wreck waiting to happen. At the same time, there were decisions made that now that these other areas of the world were neutralized, that American workers cost too much. Because remember, this whole thing about financial capitalism is that they're always going to seek the lowest cost of labor.
Yes. Well, I got to take issue with the term capitalism, because we've never experienced true capitalism. It's always been what I consider a plutocracy or an oligarchy. We've never had pure capitalism in any sense. In fact, it's always...
That's why I said financial capitalism.
Yeah.
I said because this financial... Remember, because financial capitalism is about monopolies.
Yeah. Well, that's oligarchy, and of course, what we see is the same forces that have dictated the rest of these sicknesses on us were the people behind it. Absolutely.
Exactly. So now they're finding they want to find the lowest cost of labor. So they begin to move the manufacturing out, and they begin to move the drugs in, and they also begin this huge social engineering program with something the CIA called MK Ultra, which was largely a mind control program, but they wanted to use it not only on individuals but as a social engineering program to see how they could get a group of young people to behave in a particular way that would allow them to take these drugs and to behave in a sexually promiscuous way.
That was Stanford Research Institute out in California and the Tavistock Institute over in London, if I'm not mistaken.
Exactly.
Yeah. So we know, I've treated the British East India Company extensively in shows and stuff, so my listeners are well aware of that. Let's talk here about Jackie O's men. Now, Jackie O has been identified as being from a Jewish family, believe it or not. And in fact, the Jewish community said that her first marriage to the man Onassis, who was also Jewish, was her first real marriage, because her first one was not considered real by the Jewish community because she married a Catholic. What did you find out about Jackie O, drugs, diamonds, oil for empires, and the AIDS crucible? What was that about?
Well, I looked at Jackie, and the reason I made her the central personage of this chapter was because of the men that surrounded her. For example, her first husband was, well, first of all, her mother was Jewish. Their name was actually Levi, and they changed their name to Lee. And I read Gore Vidal's it was an autobiographical novel, I think, called Palimpsest, and he basically was also, his mother was married to a man that Jackie Kennedy's mother was married to. And so he knew her very well. So Jackie seemed to want to marry up. She wanted to marry wealth. And so in that, she was successful. Her first marriage was, of course, to John Kennedy, who went on to be the President of the United States. But as many people know, Kennedy's father, who was an ambassador to Britain, but also was involved in the stock market and also was a bootlegger.
Yeah, that's right.
And it seems that, of course, if you're a bootlegger, you have to have transportation. And it seems early on in his career, he formed a relationship with Aristotle Onassis. And of course, they also, I found one reference that they also had a relationship with one of the bankers as well. I think Eugene Meyer.
Well, he also had very close ties to the Chicago Crown Prixners all the way up into the Brothmans, because he, during his bootlegging time, he would take shipments of Canadian whiskeys into his distribution network. So he had ties to the Jewish mob in Chicago as well, and Miami, through Meyer Lansky and others.
Exactly. And so the thing that people have to understand, that if you are supplying people with things that need to be transported illegally, such as opium or, during Prohibition, liquor, you have to have several things. You have to have supply networks, you have to have transportation, and you have to have somebody to launder the money. These are major financial and logistic operations.
Yep.
And that's one of the things that I really wanted to bring out in this book, because most people, when they think of drugs, they think of, you know, the poor kid on the corner, the black kid, the Hispanic kid. But these kids can hardly read a newspaper to think that they would actually be in charge of 6 to 8% of the global economy is idiotic.
That's right.
Because we're talking about big money here.
Well, Nancy, you know, we talk about Maurice Templesman, and Maurice Templesman was Jackie O's closest confidant at the end of her life, but he was part of her life throughout her post-Jack Kennedy years. And in fact, he was big in her life during her New York editor job and the rest of it. What did you find out about Maurice Templesman and HIV/AIDS in the U.S.-Israeli-African geopolitical strategy?
Well, Maurice Templesman is one of those behind-the-scenes power players. Most people, if you say Maurice Templesman, you have a blank look. They don't know who he is. And those who do know that he was one of Jackie Kennedy's liaisons, but that's about all they know. But since since he was in his 20s, Maurice Templesman has been what is known as an economic hitman for the Oppenheimers of South Africa.
Yep.
And he's been one of the biggest behind-the-scenes power players in the Democratic Party to make sure that the Oppenheimers' business deal are protected. Even during the Second World War, when the Oppenheimers were going to hold off selling industrial diamonds to the United States, and after that the United States didn't want to do business with him, it was Maurice Templesman's job to make sure that the United States continued to buy industrial diamonds from South Africa.
Well, now Templesman's Oppenheimer connection, we have to note here that Oppenheimer and Rothschild are almost synonymous. In fact, when the Boer War was being instituted in South Africa to consolidate control over those rich diamond and natural resource fields, and the killing off of the white farmers down there to take over these areas, it was Rothschild and Oppenheimer who sent the British military down to slaughter and kill and indiscriminately, and then set up the world's first modern concentration camps, where tens and tens of thousands of Afrikaner farmers died. Now, in fact, most of the racism that was born in South Africa happened after these Boers were slaughtered. In other words, these Afrikaners who moved to South Africa did not have a contentious relationship with Africans at that time. It was born out of the political control put on this place by Cecil Rhodes, who worked for Rothschild, and also who started the CFRs of Britain, which was called the Round Table. And so all of this stuff goes right back to the criminal bankers again, is my point.
Well, again, they set up the apartheid system. Well, first of all, when they first got there, you know, the diamonds were just on the surface. They were everywhere,
yes.
So they could pick them up. But, you know, the Africans basically lived off the land. They had their own history. They had their own communities and own societies. And the societies weren't monetized. So having money was not an issue for the Africans who were living in Africa. They were living quite well without money. But the way that these these people who owned who stole their land and took the mines, made them work is that they started charging them taxes.
That's right.
And if you have charged people taxes, then you say, okay, if you can't pay, then the taxes, of course, have to be paid in money. They can't be paid in goats or sheep. So that's how they got people to work in the mines. And so essentially, it was slave labor.
Yes, well, but they had to kill off that native Afrikaner group first in order to implement the control. Now there were similar actions being taken in Zimbabwe under Mugabe. They know that most of the mineral wealth of South Africa is starting to dwindle. That year on year, they're finding less and less wealth coming out of the ground. So they're moving their operations north into Zimbabwe. And what do? They kill off all the farmers. And immediately starvation takes hold. Racial strife erupts in the country, one of the wealthiest countries in all of Africa 20 years ago. It fed itself and half of its neighbors around it. The point I'm trying to make is that these people don't vary far from their plan, do they?
No, it's a scorched earth policy, and it really violates nature. It violates the earth. It violates humanity. It's a violation of everything that it means to be alive.
You're exactly right, Nancy. The next one and our last one for this broadcast, Nancy, is going to be Kissinger and Nixon, China, Vietnam, drugs, cancer, and HIV connection.
Well, one of the things that happened let me go back a little bit to the 1930s. In the 1930s, one of the members of the Warburg banking family, Otto Warburg, was a scientist, and he was a brilliant scientist. And he won several Nobel Prizes and was nominated for a third, but he really understood the mechanism for cancer. He understood that cancer was essentially an energy problem, and that the energy that we make was diminished, and as a result, the cells were not able to be as differentiated. So cancer was an energy problem. This idea of cancer being an energy problem did not go along with the Rockefeller idea of mechanistic biology, because they were promoting eugenics and the gene theory of cancer. And so just as Otto Warburg's research was coming to fruition, and they were probably going to be developing natural means for overcoming cancer, here comes Richard Nixon and his war on cancer. In 1966, Otto Warburg makes a very important speech at Landau in Germany about knowing the cause of cancer. About 4 years later, Richard Nixon declares the war on cancer, and all of the money that was going towards unscrambling the cancer paradigm now was going to go into saying viruses were the cause of cancer. Like overnight, they just decided viruses were the cause of cancer, and they were going to put all this money into finding a viral cause of cancer. Mm-hmm. And so Richard Nixon's war on cancer was never really a war on cancer. It was more money to the Rockefeller people who wanted to find a viral cause of cancer so they could make more vaccines.
Well,
it
now
had nothing to do with science.
They've supported that thesis that virus causes cancer by saying, and there's a lot of people in the so-called truth movement, one of them, this guy Alex Jones, who says cancer has been sent everywhere by the green monkey experiments of a green monkey virus having cancer and then giving it to people in vaccine form. And so that's how cancer got into our human population, because they started inoculating people with a diseased kidney from a green monkey. And now this has been sent around to everybody, and a lot of people believe that as being true. Now, what I know about cancer is that certain deficits erupt in the body, and you've described them as energy problems, and that if they're not met with the proper care, they morph into further deterioration of the cell. And I mean, that's being a layman's description. I'm not a doctor,
yeah,
but I'll just
go over it briefly because it's basically pretty easy to understand without going to heavy duty biology. But essentially, every cell in our body has a nucleus where our DNA is, which we inherit from our mother and our father. But it also has a second DNA called the mitochondria, which is where we make most of our energy, called ATP. The mitochondria is an ancient bacteria which came into our cells about 2 billion years ago, and it allowed for the diversification of life on the planet, the use of oxygen for energy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the importance of this mitochondria also is that it's only inherited through the maternal germline. The major DNA is inherited from both the mother and the father. Now, the cell, being an ancient cell, also has another way of producing energy, and it produces this ATP also in the cell cytoplasm, but it's much less efficient. So if you are taking oxidizing agents into your body over time, your cell is not able to produce energy efficiently, and it damages these mitochondria. And so as the mitochondria become damaged, the cell becomes less differentiated, and it reverts back to its prehistoric characteristics. And that's basically cancer. Cancer is just the cell trying to protect itself and trying to live on when you, the human, are not giving yourself the energy source that you need. And it goes back to energy. It's all about energy metabolism. This whole paradigm about DNA is the effect. Energy is the cause.
Now, this green monkey kidney stuff is just nonsense.
Well, the thing about introducing vaccines is that vaccines, again, are toxins. Many times they're laced with heavy metals and other oxidizing agents, and they're very difficult to get out of your body. So once they're in your body, that means they're taking your stored energy from your body. And over time, these things can cause damage. But it's not the viruses per se. It's the body trying to get rid of toxins, which it's not able to get rid of.
Now, what I understand about virus as well is it has an important positive function in the body of ridding the body of certain waste products from the cells. And so a virus is not necessarily a negative. And a lot of people hear the word virus and they want to run for the hills, when in fact the genesis of a virus or viral environment in the body is actually part of our normal system of exiting toxins and the rest of it. Am I right or wrong about that? It's probably...
let me say this. The whole issue of viruses, I think, would need another show. So
okay, all right.
Because it's complicated, I don't want to go into
okay.
it right now.
Okay, I agree with that. Well, what we're going to do here, we've gotten through half of this, and we have a lot of shared time to do here, Nancy. The thing about it, your website, do you have, you don't have a website yet.
My website, I finally had someone who was doing my website who wasn't working appropriately. So now I have someone that I'm working with who's working on a new website, which will be up within the next week or so. But the website that is there does have the first chapter of the book, and so people can read the first chapter. If they want to order the book, they can order the book from Barnes & Noble's or Amazon online.
Will you be able to later on ship for yourself? Are you going to get a couple of copies of your own to ship out?
That will happen in the near future.
Okay. So give everybody your website, and I will also carry the connection to your website as well.
So right now the website is www.nancybanksmd.com.
Okay. All one word, nancybanksmd.com. And Nancy, you've known me now for a few years. I got to be honest with you. We haven't we haven't got a handle on defeating these people. However, I think the learning curve has expanded. I think a lot more people are coming to the facts, and they're even becoming emboldened as to identifying at the very top who's doing this. Of course, many people were afraid to because of political correctness and fear. But I think some of those fears, as we see people starting to struggle, are melting away. And I think people are becoming emboldened for the truth. And I'm wondering what your take is on that statement, and if you have any parting statements for the listeners today.
Well, you know, the reason I started my book with talking about how we form our worldview and how our worldview is formed for us is the idea that we sometimes reach the limits of what we know, and then we're fearful to go further. And I really implore people to start reading and thinking, and think about the things that you think are common knowledge, which are just not true. Think of all the times, especially over the last 8 years or so, that the government has lied to the American people. Think about the lies that they told about the economy, the lies that they told to get us into Iraq, and think about the fact that the pharmaceutical industry has received so many fines for putting so many bad drugs into the American people, and actually killing so many. They've killed at least 1 million people since 9/11. And so I think that people really need to start thinking about protecting themselves, not only from this information, but from the poisons that are simply being put into people's bloodstreams.
I agree. I agree 100%. I know that a lot of the information early on you got from my website, because I've in the beginning, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, nobody was putting out the stuff I had out there, and I'm so happy to see so many new websites coming up online that have similar and even information I haven't found yet. They've actually taken it further than myself. I feel proud of the fact that a lot of this stuff was given birth on my site, because I've only been a conduit for information, basically, and my listeners have been so important to me learning about what's really going on in this world. And I think I have a good grasp of the subject, so I'm able to kind of weed through it. And I think basically that's what we all do. You know, when you were deconstructing these lies, basically you have to be able to discern fact from fantasy, and that's not an easy thing to do, but it's getting easier. Now that we know the culprits and we can get a history of them, Nancy, it's getting easier to find out where we've gone wrong and what we can do about it.
I think so, and I think the most important thing for me as a physician and just as a human who cares about other humans is that I want to see the world healthy. You know, this is a rich world with a lot of resources, and the idea that there's scant resources is just another lie that's put into people's minds. It's not that there are scant resources, it's that there are a few people who want to hoard, and we are in a situation where the hoarders are destroying what's beautiful for the rest of us, and we must stop it.
Absolutely. Ladies and gentlemen, Nancy Turner Banks, MD, my friend, and I'm so proud of her work. It's a great book. Anybody out there who wants to learn a lot about these subjects, it's a seminal work in my view, and she's actually had some really good reception from many people in the profession of medicine. She deserves your support, as well as the interest in her book. And I want to thank her again. Nancy, thank you.
Thank you, Daryl.
Ladies and gentlemen, until the next time, this is Daryl Bradford Smith telling you all, please take care of your families. We are heading into the autumn. These crooks have some new surprises for us. We've got to be ready to protect our families and make sure that we can bring these facts to as many people as possible. Until the next time, it's Daryl Bradford Smith telling you all, please be well. Bye-bye now.